This is Infants on Thrones, the philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the Quorum.
Welcome back to another episode of Infants on Thrones. My name's Tom Perry. Wow, a lot really has happened in regards to this recent sex abuse scandal in the LDS Church, even since that previous timeline minisode that I put together. So let's get started on hitting on some of the bigger developments that have happened recently, and even maybe touch on some of the things that I failed to mention in that previous minisode. First thing that I want to mention right off the bat is that I'm going to be referring to the original survivor in that Joseph Bishop confession as McKenna Denson. The reason why I'm going to be using her name moving forward is that she has recently come out and revealed her identity and name to the public. So I feel it's appropriate to use her name to hopefully lessen any confusion going forward. Again, I will be including all of the news links and references that I'll be using in the show notes of this episode. Greg Bishop, a lawyer located out of Park City, Utah, appears to be the lawyer representing Joseph Bishop, who, coincidentally, happens to be his father. Greg Bishop has compiled a file in an attempt to discredit and smear the reputation of McKenna. Some of the information in the circulated file included her previous sexual history, past legal troubles, and other accusations from her past. We know this because McKenna's lawyer CC'd Greg Bishop in his complaint letter. That is why he was included on the church's lawyer's response, and presumably how he received the information. Greg Bishop allegedly got most, if not all, of his information from outside counsel representing the LDS Church. What this means is the church lawyers gave the perpetrator's son all of the negative information that they could find on McKenna to presumably destroy her credibility. Greg Bishop went public with this information on March 20th, 2018, sending this information that he had prepared to various news outlets. This all happened on the same day that the church's statement claimed that as a religious organization, it had limited, quote, investigative tools. There is conflicting information on which news outlets got the files with names redacted, but we do know that at least some news outlets received the information without McKenna's name or the name of her family members redacted. It should be mentioned that it is completely unethical for a victim of sexual assault to have their name publicly released without their consent. On March 21st, 2018, Greg Bishop says to the Washington Post that his father, Joseph Bishop, was only apologizing in the recording because the survivor, now known as McKenna, had exposed her breast to him unsolicited, and he was worried that he had done something to make her feel like it would be okay for her to do that. Quote, "It's always troubled him that a woman would feel that it would be appropriate or well-received or acceptable for her to bare her breast to him." Greg Bishop was also quoted saying to the Washington Post, quote, "So he's carried some guilt about that because he didn't think it was appropriate." Then on March 22nd, after news reported about Joseph Bishop's confession to the police back in December of 2017, including the part where he asked the young women to show him her breasts instead of her doing it unsolicited, Greg Bishop mentions to the Washington Post that he wouldn't comment on the police report until he had a full recording of it. On March 23, 2018, the second victim from Joseph Bishop is acknowledged by the Deseret News. The church also acknowledges that it was aware of the second victim in the updated statement on March 23rd. Quote, "We are aware of one other woman who is referenced in the December recording who informed her local ecclesiastical leaders that she was sexually abused by Joseph Bishop while he served as president of the Missionary Training Center. When she reported the alleged abuse to her local church leaders in 2010, they provided emotional support as well as professional counseling services. Mr. Bishop's local ecclesiastical leaders were contacted, and they confronted him with her claims, which he denied. And local leaders did not feel they could pursue church discipline for Mr. Bishop." Prior to the Joseph Bishop confession audio being released, the LDS Church told the Protect LDS Children movement that their policies regarding bishops were just fine the way they were. On March 22nd, and just a few days prior to the Protect LDS Children's March protest, which was held in downtown Salt Lake City on March 30th, the LDS Church announces that they have updated their policies to now allow a parent to be present at bishops' interviews. On March 22nd, 2018, McKenna then goes on KUTV News anonymously to share her story. On March 30th, 2018, KUTV acquires information that shows that the LDS Church assisted Greg Bishop in digging up dirt on McKenna, including releasing private information from her ecclesiastical interviews. On March 31st, 2018, during General Conference on Saturday, a woman named Crystal yells out during a quiet moment, "Stop protecting sexual predators," three times. Crystal came out publicly, announcing her name and her motivations, and she was also recently interviewed on the Mormon Happy Hour podcast. On April 4th, 2018, the Salt Lake Tribune reports that McKenna's daughter, that she had relinquished for adoption, had her private information leaked to the press. Her closed adoption, through LDS Family Services, made its way into the dossier, and her name appeared on the documents Greg Bishop used. On April 5th, 2018, McKenna announces that she is formally suing the church. It is then when the public becomes aware of who she is and her identity. And now I'm going to play the entire audio of McKenna's press conference.
My name is Craig Vernon, and along with Jeff Forrest, we are proud to represent McKenna Denson in this lawsuit that was filed yesterday. What I'd like to do is say a few words, and then we're going to have McKenna's friend, Rebecca Rose, read a very short letter from McKenna's 13-year-old daughter, Emily Signier. And then we're going to turn the time over to McKenna. That's why everybody's here. We're going to have McKenna tell her story. And then we'll simply open it up to questions if anybody has any follow-up questions. The reason McKenna filed this lawsuit is twofold. First, she wants justice. And second, she wants policy change. And let me first talk about justice. Part of justice is having the sexual predator who raped her bear some accountability and responsibility for what has happened. The criminal statute of limitations has run. He cannot be prosecuted. The church, from what we're aware, has never disciplined him. And so a civil lawsuit is a remedy where she can seek some accountability on the part of the sexual predator. She also seeks accountability on the part of the institution who put this sexual predator in the MTC in a position of power over her. The church who joined McKenna and this perpetrator where she could be raped and sexually assaulted. After this rape occurred, starting in about 1987, McKenna didn't go to the police. McKenna didn't go to attorneys. Since 1987 until recently, McKenna went back to the church over and over again, seeking help, seeking justice, seeking accountability. Nothing happened. McKenna wasn't believed. McKenna was blamed, and McKenna was shamed. Because of this, because McKenna wasn't believed, a few weeks ago, McKenna underwent a polygraph test. And I've got that right here. And this probably isn't admissible in court, but we thought it's important because she passed this polygraph test with flying colors to show that What she said happened in that dark basement, in that hidden room, in the MTC happened. The second thing McKenna desires out of this lawsuit is change. And I'd like to recognize Sam Young, who's here. Sam, can you say hi? I just met Sam for the first time today. We talked on the phone several times before this. But last Friday, Sam led a march. Sam is from protectldschildren.org, and he led a march to the church office building. He led a march for change, him and everybody else that marched with him, into a movement for change. And McKenna wants the same thing. McKenna wants change. In fact, one part in our lawsuit, and this is on page 16 of the complaint, we ask for change. We're asking the court to order that the church change its policies. And what I want to do right now is I'm going to assume that somebody from the church is going to listen to this. And I don't want to talk about litigation. I want to ask the church to consider possibly changing its policies. Not to worry about the litigation on this issue of changing policies, but just consider, does it make sense to change policies? And we have some suggestions, a simple suggestion, but it's a fundamental change. So right now, if a member of the church finds out about sexual assault or physical abuse, domestic violence, in their Mormon community or a church activity, that member is told to go tell their bishop. You know, if you think back to the Rob Porter story, that was a pretty publicized story. What did his wives do when they were abused by him, when they were victims of domestic violence? They went and talked to their bishops. We want the church to consider, if it makes sense for them, to instruct their members not to tell the bishop, but to go to the police. When you learn of a crime, go to the police. Right now in Handbook 1, that's the handbook for the bishops and state presidents. It instructs the bishops and state presidents, if they learn of a crime relating to sexual assault, domestic abuse, something of that nature, they're supposed to call a helpline. And again, our complaint, we put it right in bold here. Learn of a crime, don't call the helpline, call the police. And we want the church to consider whether it makes sense to instruct the bishops and state presidents. If you find out about one of these crimes, and you find out from somebody other than the perpetrator of the abuse, if the perpetrator confesses, those are some different issues, but if you find out from the victim of abuse, or you find out from somebody who just learns of the crime, don't call the helpline, call the police. And we hope the church will take that into consideration to see if that makes sense for them. We think it does. Because there's a lot of people thinking what one brave soul shouted out at General Conference over the weekend. Stop protecting sexual predators. And we'd like to thank Crystal Legionaries for shouting that out, because I know a lot of people are thinking that. And it also makes sense, because if you stop protecting sexual predators, what are you going to do? You're going to protect the vulnerable members of the church, those people that are vulnerable to sexual assault, children, women, those people that are vulnerable to domestic violence. You're going to protect them. So we hope the church will consider that, not worry about the litigation, but simply consider those policy changes. One more quick topic before we turn it over to Rebecca to read the letter from McKenna's daughter. In General Conference over the weekend, there was a talk by a high-level Mormon official, and he coined the phrase non-consensual immorality. That's a term that's apparently an ecclesiastical term. That's a term that, in my mind, connotes sin. That's not a term that we're going to use here today. Because when McKenna followed her mission president from his office down to the basement in the dark and dingy tunnel into that hidden room in the church's MTC, that was not non-consensual immorality. That was a crime. McKenna was sexually assaulted McKenna was raped. It needs to be called a crime. It needs to be treated as a crime. So now let's turn the time over to Rebecca. She's going to come up. We're going to have a picture of McKenna's daughter that Sam, Jeff is going to hold. And the letter will be fairly brief. Go ahead, Rebecca.
Hi, I'm Emily Sinier, the daughter of McKenna Benson. My mom was sexually abused by a member of the church who was very high up. But this doesn't mean she's anti-Mormon or anything of the sort. She is an intelligent, beautiful, strong woman. I'm proud to call her my mom. She was the type of woman who would lift you up anywhere, anytime. The type that protects you from the fear in the world, makes sure you are happy, and the type of woman who is a role model. My mom is doing this to protect the next generation and allow us to be heard. I love you, Mom. Hashtag role model mommy. Love, Emily Sinier.
Okay. I'm McKenna. I'm the woman who's in the recording interviewing Joseph Bishop about the rape in the MTC. There are a few things I'd like to say first before we get into that. And one of those things is how grateful I am to the media who kept the story on track. Because the story is not about me. The story is not necessarily about Joseph Bishop. The story is about the rape in the MTC by a high-level Mormon official, which was the MTC president. The rape, and then the cover-up. I am grateful to the media who has continued to bring that back into focus. In light of the dossier that the church has developed on me and sent out, this isn't about me. This isn't about, it's not just my story. There are so many survivors of sexual assault. This is all of us standing together hand in hand, becoming an unstoppable force. The people that went before me, long before me, who came forward with accusations against priests, who came forward with accusations against other political figures, those are the courageous people. I'm just, because of them, I'm able to do what I'm doing today. The Me Too movement is not the reason that I sought out Joseph Bishop. I've been trying for 30 years, 3 decades to get the truth from the church, even some kind of acknowledgement that Joseph Bishop admitted what he did, or an acknowledgement that he denied it. However, the Me Too movement and the Time's Up movement is the reason I had courage to get on that plane, to fly to Arizona and interview Joseph Bishop. Without that courage, I don't believe I would have ever been believed. It gave me the courage to understand that maybe this time, someone would believe me. And so I went to Arizona and I interviewed President Bishop. I have a really strong support team, a physical friends and family support team. And those people are also the reason I had courage to do what I did. One of them is my beautiful daughter. You just saw her picture, Emily Sinier. Thank you for your incredibly brave and kind words for a 13-year-old. Rebecca Rose. Rebecca Rose is my friend who was on the phone with me for an hour before I interviewed Joseph Bishop, going through the things that I might say that might draw him out and make him more vulnerable to telling the truth. Another is my friend Catherine Sisney, who has been friends with me for a very long time. An attorney named Drake Larson from Pueblo, Colorado, and his paralegal, Julianne Smith, and my good friend, Natalie. I also want to thank the online support. When this story broke, I wasn't sure how it would be received, which was less important to me than getting the facts out. But I have read your comments. I have read your stories. I have read your letters. Thank you for that. To Crystal, the courageous woman, courageous, I can't even tell you how much this meant to me, who stood up in general conference during a worldwide broadcast and brought attention to the fact that the church protects sexual predators. She said it three times. I would have never been able to do that. I don't have the courage to do that. Thank you, Crystal. And thank you to the general authority who coined the phrase, non-consensual immorality. Thank you. There's a shift in our culture right now. Maybe 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 8 years ago, discrediting and victim shaming the victim of sexual assault or rape or domestic violence would have worked. It doesn't work now. There's been a tectonic shift, really, that has caused a ripple and then a wave and then a tidal wave. And guess what? Right now, the gates are open and the tsunami's coming. We stand strong, the victims and survivors of domestic violence and sexual abuse. And together, we are unstoppable. Forgive me, I don't have my glasses. So I think it's time to talk a little bit about my history. Many of you know that I grew up in a family with a violently abusive stepfather. He was a pedophile. Then I went to high school, and I met there were some students there that were so devoted to their beliefs. And those people really inspired me. And I started asking questions. I learned that they were Mormon. I had never even heard of a Mormon before. But it changed my life. I started taking the missionary lessons, and I loved the gospel. I felt joy. I felt peace. I felt safe for the first time in my life. And I was 15 years old when I took the missionary lessons. So I decided to go on a mission, because I wanted to share that joy and that peace and that safety with the world. So I was really excited to go on a mission. And for the first time, I felt like I had a divine purpose, which I never felt like I had before. Okay, so the MTC. The first day I got to the MTC, I went to the MTC without family, without friends. I went alone, as many others did, some either coming from non-member families or perhaps coming from a different part of the country. So I got there the first day, and there were families everywhere. And then that evening, the mission president had a welcoming in an auditorium, and he called on me specifically to bear my testimony, which I did. The next meeting, where the missionaries all met together, he called on me again to give the prayer. Joseph Bishop sought me out individually. He started calling me out of class. My Spanish didn't develop much. He'd call me out of class and have me come to his room. The first time he did that, there were three other sister missionaries in that room. It was his MTC office. So there were three other sister missionaries there, and we were asked very explicit questions about our sexual trauma as children. It was traumatizing, because I had already put so much of that behind me. I had to revisit that trauma in an interview with my mission president, who I believed was trying to counsel us, was trying to make us feel better about going on our missions, and that those childhood traumas did not minimize who we were in any way. Then I had two or three other experiences with President Bishop in his main office with another sister missionary, talking about the same types of things. And then it became one-on-one. So I was called out of class to visit with the MTC president in his office, one-on-one. Those conversations were inappropriate and sexual in nature. Then President Bishop asked me if I would be interested in seeing the room where he prepared all of his talks, where he did his spiritual contemplating and praying. And I said, yeah, I'd love that. You have to understand that President Bishop made me feel special. He told me I was special. He told me I was going to be amazing. I had never had anyone in the church that was so high ranking ever pay any attention to me. I loved it. I needed it. I was desperate for it, particularly a man, because my stepfather was so abusive. So we went down the dark tunnel, really. He unlocked the room where he had a bed, a TV, a VCR, and unlabeled VHS tapes. I did not watch any of the tapes. I cannot confirm or deny what was on those tapes. I have my own thoughts on that, but they're not relevant. Joseph Bishop tore my blouse open, pulled my garments and pantyhose down. He pulled his pants down. He was not fully erect, but when he penetrated me, he pulled away and he was trying to make himself hard so he could complete the rape. And that's when I was able to kick and get away from him. When I was pulling up my pantyhose and trying to button my blouse or put myself together, he said to me, "No one will believe you. Look at you. Look at me. Look at you. Look at me." So when I left his secret room in the basement, I went to my dorm and I lay down and I pretended I was sick. I didn't tell anyone what happened to me until I spoke to my singles ward bishop, who then arranged an interview with me and Elder Carlos E. Acey of the 70. I got married, moved to Taiwan, started living my life. A little while later, I started asking questions to the church. Could you give me some update? Could you let me know what happened? We're taught in the church that we don't go to the police. We go to the bishop. We go to the stake president. And trusting that and obeying that and believing that, that's the reason why I didn't go to the police all those years ago. It was never suggested to me that that would be appropriate. So I went through the church for 3 decades. I didn't get answers. And finally, November of 2017, I reached out to the BYU Police Department, who told me that I'd been raped. I had never even thought that I'd been raped. It didn't occur to me that that legal definition, what happened to me in the basement of the MTC, was rape. I always thought it was sexual assault. But now I know. So I found out where President Bishop was, flew out to Arizona, and I interviewed him. And, you know, I had no idea that he had assaulted all those other women. I didn't know that until I interviewed with him. So I'm really grateful that I took that recording. I didn't know that the church had covered up the crime. I didn't know that Elder Wells had already been confessed to by Joseph Bishop about his previous sexual assaults until that day, December 2nd, 2017, during that interview with President Bishop. I do want to share one more thing. When I was 15 and I was interviewing for baptism, I had a priesthood leader who was interviewing me and asked some really inappropriate questions sexually. I hadn't had sex. I hadn't even had a boyfriend at that point. But having been sexually assaulted by my stepfather, I wasn't quite sure how to answer those questions. But that was the very beginning of being told or being reinforced over and over again that it's okay to sit behind closed doors with a priesthood leader, and it's okay for those priesthood leaders to ask you sexually explicit questions. You know what? It is not okay. If I didn't have that experience, if I didn't think it was okay to be one-on-one with a priesthood leader, I would have never been in a room, an office with President Joseph Bishop talking about sexually explicit conversations. Red flags would have been going up, left, right, left, right. But the truth is, we're taught that in the church. We trust our priesthood leaders. We obey our priesthood leaders. And we do as we are instructed to do. So the movement to protect our children is absolutely vital in this case. Because if I had been taught early on, it is not okay to be alone, one-on-one, with a priesthood leader, no matter how high up he is, I honestly believe this would not have happened. Thank you.
What I would like to do now, I want to give one more introduction before we open it up to questions. I want to introduce Judy Larson. She's just in the back holding up a sign. And Judy is the local representative for SNAP. SNAP is a wonderful organization called Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. It was started by a group of wonderful people who were abused by Catholic priests. But of course, SNAP is larger than just, you know, the Catholic sexual abuse crisis. It involves itself in all of these important issues. And so I want to recognize Judy here. And frankly, if there's anybody that is listening to this press conference that is hurting, that is a survivor of childhood sexual abuse, a survivor of sexual assault, SNAP, S-N-A-P, Survivor Network of Those Abused by Priests, is a wonderful resource. You can look it up online, and Judy can be there. Barbara could be there. Other people at SNAP can be there to help you. So I just want to, you know, tell people about that. Okay. Right now we want to open it up for questions. We're going to let people ask all the questions they want. I will tell you, we may or may not answer those questions. I don't want to be rude, but we may or may not answer those questions. I think people understand why. So if you could just designate the question either to, you know, McKenna or her lawyers. If it's a legal question about the lawsuit, I'll probably have Jeff answer it, but we can go from there. Go ahead, Ben.
To both of you, actually, Mr. Bishop's family has accused you of making false claims.
Saying yes.
You have a history of false claims.
Yes.
And that these are more false claims. Your response to that accusation?
You know, there are a lot of accusations out there. The truth is, I have a criminal history. I do. I have a criminal record. I'm not proud of that. But I own that. Anything I have ever done in my life that I've actually done, I own that. Is it shameful? Yes. Am I embarrassed? Yes. There are a lot of false accusations in that dossier. There are actual facts that have been twisted so much that they are not really true. So my answer is, we have to pull it back to the facts. What are the facts? The facts are, go back to the tape. Don't read the transcript. Listen to the tape. Listen to what he says and the way he says it. So, yes, I do have things in my past that are shameful, but that does not take away the fact that he raped me at the Missionary Training Center in Provo, Utah.
Ben, just to follow up on that, I'll echo what McKenna said. The recording, the BYU police report, we have a polygraph. If anybody's interested in the raw data for that polygraph, we can send that along. Just shoot me an email.
And I would also like to say there's someone else that is very important, and that's Jan Tyler. I don't know if any of you are aware of who she is. Some of you are. She was the dean, the women's dean, the dean of women's affairs, yes, at Weber State. And she's the first woman that I'm aware of when Joseph Bishop was president of Weber State to come out and really talk about his character. And that was a long time before me. And I want to thank Jan because she stood alone. She didn't have social media. She didn't have people standing behind her and backing her up, at least not publicly. What a courageous woman. Thank you, Jan, for your courage.
Yes.
I have a question regarding the helpline.
Could you identify yourself and where you're from?
I'm just a member of the public.
Oh, great. What's your name?
My name is Millie Pilmer.
Thank you, Millie.
Yes.
Go ahead.
One would assume that goes to like a police type of situation. Does that just go to like someone that answers legal advice, or like what does the helpline do right now?
I will answer that question by asking you to ask the church what it does.
I will.
But that is a great question.
Yes.
Since you filed your litigation, have you heard from the LDS Church? Are they interested in re-engaging in settlement talks?
I have not. I emailed the LDS Church's attorney the complaint last night. I have not heard from them, but I haven't checked my email today either. So.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for doing this, by the way. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm Miguel with KWR News.
Thank you.
Can you give me an example of what you would imagine being a satisfying policy change the church can make right now? Maybe just kind of pinpoint. I know there's a lot.
You're absolutely right. There are several. One policy change that we would like to see goes back to protect the children, and that is to not have sexually explicit questions in the interviews. Now, we appreciate the fact that the church has come out since the march and said that they will allow parents in on those conversations, those interviews with bishops and priesthood leaders and children, but it doesn't really go far enough. They need to not be asking sexually explicit questions to the children and make the children think that that's okay. Yes, sir.
Yes.
A Brady from Associated Press. Where do you stand now with your Mormon faith?
You know, I love the gospel. I have had very, very many friends that are LDS, that are Mormon, that are amazing, amazing people. But there are Joseph Bishops in the church, and there are general authorities that cover up rape and abuse. To those people, I say, here we come. The rest of the public, the rest of the Mormons, you know, they're just normal, God-loving people that are trying to do the best they can, and I support that too.
And to this note, again, this lawsuit is not just about justice for McKenna. It is, and that's part of it, believe me. But hopefully people can see that we want to make this organization a safer place to those who will be vulnerable to sexual assault, domestic abuse. We join arms with Sam Young to make it safer for the LDS kids. And that's the reality. That's why we have that in our complaint. That is something we are seeking. So.
And also, I think it's also important to make a safe platform for victims, men and women and children, to be able to come forward and not feel like the church is going to create some dossier on them to keep them silent or to shame them.
Craig, Chris Jones from 2 News.
Yes.
What are your thoughts about the information gathered about McKenna by attorneys for the church and also the way that it ended up in the hands of some members of the media?
First, I don't know how it ended up in the hands of the media. I will also say I respect the attorneys for the church, David Jordan. I respect the attorneys at Curtin McConkie that I have dealt with. And I don't know how it ended up in the hands of the media. I will say that because we asserted a claim, the church has every right to use their vast resources to do exactly what they did on McKenna. The question is, should have the church done that? I think that's the question we should be asking. Do they have the legal right to do that? Absolutely. The question is, should they be doing that? Go ahead, Ben.
To that nature, on the nature of civil litigation, you're making a claim against the church, and how difficult is it going to be for you to make that argument that the corporation, or in this instance, the corporation of the presiding bishop,
is responsible for the conduct of an individual per se, because I can see their defense saying, we are not responsible for the conduct of an individual.
Sure, and that's the defense. Jeff, do you want to speak to that?
Well, yeah, I mean, without going too far, because obviously, you know, we've got presumably a lot of litigation ahead of us, and I don't want to divulge strategy or that or so forth. But on the one hand, yes, presumably the church will say, well, this is an individual, you know, he's taking actions that we certainly don't condone, we don't have any responsibility for it. But in fact, you look at this individual, you look at his history in the church and his continual progression up to higher and higher levels of authority. You look at what we've alleged in the complaint about his admitting to yet another higher authority of his acts, and then he continues to stay in the church, and there's no punishment that we're aware of. So it's not an easy thing, we don't think, for the church to simply wash their hands of him. And since this has all been coming out anyway, they haven't washed their hands of him. So I guess that's my answer.
Has there been admissions, basically, in past statements, in recent statements, admissions of culpability in your mind on behalf of the church?
Well, you know what is out there, and presumably you've either heard the tape, the video, or sorry, not the video, the audio, or the transcript. And as far as any admissions, I don't really want to speak to that at this point because of the litigation.
Yes, Brady?
There's a second woman that he mentions in the recording, it sounds like, in a church that they're investigating a second incident. Do you represent her, plan to represent her? Do you know if she's been a follow through the lawsuit?
We have no comment on that.
Have you been approached by other potential plaintiffs?
No comment on that.
Craig, you mentioned earlier that the church gets in the habit of encouraging people to go to the police, right, not going to the bishop. I know something in Mormon culture that probably will never change. I mean, there's always many people who would like to go to the bishop. So along with protecting the children and that kind of nature, how would you advise the church to change the way that they do report abuse and that, how that situation is handled if the bishop continues to be the point person?
And that's a great question, because you can throw out a written policy change, but what you said was so important. The church must change the culture, because it doesn't really occur to people in these situations to ever go to the police, because that's not only the policy, but that is the culture. And so I don't know how the church is going to do that, but it needs to change the culture. It needs to have a written policy that's very specific. You learn of a crime, you call the police. And they need to read that from the pulpit. They need to do whatever they can to change that culture. It's a process, but you're right. It's a culture. I grew up in the church. I understand that. And it's a thing that's going to take a long, long time. And I think the time to start is now. Go ahead.
I was actually signaling.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But I do want to just confirm, Gardner, with Telemundo, just to be perfectly clear, you are not commenting on whether or not there are more victims if you've in all those, 4 years that he was in prison, there, you're not commenting.
Right, no comment right now. Thank you, Garner.
McKenna,
go ahead, sir.
In totality, how many different Mormon leaders did you tell over the years?
No, I have sat down to go over that myself. Many. I don't want to give a specific number because I really have to reevaluate and go back through what I told and whom I told. So if you don't mind, I'd like to revisit that at another time. You've had your hand up on and off.
Yes.
I'm so sorry.
John DeLand, Mormon Stories Podcast.
Yes, sir.
I'm curious what Mormons, post-Mormons, and the general public can do to support your efforts.
Oh, crikey. Mm-hmm. Good question. You know, I think what's really important and what is going to pick up and move forward with this tsunami is that people feel comfortable coming forward and say, hey, me too. Tell their story. I'm sorry. I'm really, really sorry that the church put out this dossier, because I know that even though I really don't care, everyone else thinks, oh my gosh, now the church has these dossiers. So if I come forward and I say, this happened to me, the church may create a smear campaign for them. You know, I have no skeletons in my closet that I'm afraid of. When we first received the dossier, I think the idea was that it would intimidate me and scare me into silence. It did not.
Any other questions? Let's go to, and we'll come right back to you. Thanks.
McKenna Blatty, KSL-TV. I'm interested in your reaction to the BYU police report.
Yeah.
Where detectives say that Bishop admitted to asking you to expose yourself to him. And then the prosecutors following up with a note that they would press charges if the statute of limitations hadn't expired. Did you feel vindicated by that report? I'm interested in your reaction.
Well, let's go back to the asking me to expose my breasts, which he claims that I did. That's another victim. That was not me. The second part, I felt, you know, I want to give a real good shout out, really, to the BYU police. Not only did I feel believed by the BYU police, they drove to my house in Colorado and interviewed me. And then they drove to Arizona and interviewed Joseph Bishop. They handled my case with such professionalism and compassion. They were amazing. They made me feel like I was believed. So I appreciate them.
And I think this underscores the reason why the church should stick to dealing with sin, allow police to deal with crime.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Yes, yes sir.
In the letter from your daughter, they mentioned how you're not anti-Mormon in coming out with this story. I think that culturally maybe something that's stopping a Mormon Me Too moment from happening is that abuse stories becoming public is seen as anti-Mormon. And just curious,
sure.
Your thoughts about that.
Sure. I'm not anti-Mormon because I believe that people in the Mormon Church, the vast majority of those people are really good people. They're honest people. They want to do the right thing. They try to do the right thing. They try to be loving and compassionate, and they try to just live their lives. I think that I'm not anti anything in terms, I'm not anti-Muslim, I'm not anti-Catholic, I'm not anti anything, except I will say this, I am absolutely against those who cover up sexual abuse. I am absolutely against those who try to shame and victimize victims and survivors. So I'm against those people. But that was a great question. Thank you for asking that.
Yes.
So, Garnier and Telmundo, so I'm guessing for you it was obviously a traumatic experience. You're at the MTC, you're preparing to go and speak about Christ for, 18 months?
Yes.
What was that like to go back to your room, and then did you just kind of go about, were you processing everything? Did you go about your regular routine the next several weeks and head out? How did that, I guess my question is, how did that affect your life and, you know, your relationship with your God?
At that time at the MTC, I went back to my room and I tried to erase it. I did not want to believe that the MTC president raped me. I didn't even want to believe it, and it had just happened to me. I put it aside, I compartmentalized it so that I could continue on thinking to myself that this was a one-time event, that it was somehow my fault that I went to this rape room, and I allowed myself to be in that situation. I thought it was my fault. So I blamed myself for a while, and I shamed myself, and I believed him when he said, "No one will believe you. Look at you. Look at me." So I didn't even process it. I did not process it. Yes, ma'am.
My name is Lisa Murphy. I'm just a member of the public and here to support.
Thank you.
Well. The church put out their, I don't know what you call it, they said that you served briefly as a missionary. And a lot of members took that as code, as you did not complete your mission, and that somehow that made you less credible. And so I would like to give you the opportunity to respond to that.
People who are true blue Mormon, true believing Mormons, do not want to believe that happened. They don't want to believe that the church covered up sexual assault for three decades. They don't want to believe that it could happen to their own children. They don't want to believe that, gosh, if I send my children to the missionary training center, they might be raped. They don't want to believe that. I don't want to believe that. I understand that thought process. But the church was trying to minimize my credibility. Absolutely they were. They were in full-on protect the church mode.
Yes, go ahead.
Sarah Martin, ABC 4 News. Thank you, first of all, for speaking out for doing this.
Thank you.
Well, I'm confused about how he knew about your abuse of the child. I mean, how he was initially able to wrangle up four sister missionaries and talk to them about their sexual past.
Okay. You know, thank you for that. If you don't mind, I'd like Craig to answer that for me.
Okay, we don't know exactly how he knew, but to single her out to bear her testimony amongst 12,000 missionaries that arrived that day, and I know some of you here serve missions, 1,200 missionaries. You know that big, opening session in the MTC. I understand McKenna was a victim of sexual assault. She had a child out of wedlock. She put it up for adoption through LDS Social Services. Mm-hmm. McKenna had to go through a special process to go on her mission. It wasn't just the interview with the bishop and stake president. So I don't know if the record was flagged, but it sure would be curious that he could single her out like that. And then of course the three other sister missionaries she met with in the room also had similar situations. And why he singled those ones out, I will let you decide what you think the reason was. I've got my hunches.
Thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
McKenna, my name is Janine Gillespie. I just am here as a woman representing other women.
Thank you.
We support them, we love you. And we can. One of the questions from another woman was, what was your experience? Did he approach you after the rape? And what was the rest of your MTC experience with him like?
First of all, thank you. Okay. So after the rape at the MTC, Joseph Bishop would continually try to call me out of class. I wouldn't go. He would, in the crowd going, the crowd of missionaries going to the cafeteria to eat, he would try to get my attention. I ignored him. I did not speak to that man again until December 2nd of 2017.
All right, any other questions? Go ahead, in the back.
Greg, Don Hoffman with KUTV.
Okay.
Recently, a lawsuit appears to have been settled with the LDS Church and a group of former members in West Virginia.
Yes.
It appears that when you initially reached out to the church earlier this year, it may have been to start some sort of settlement negotiations or at least broach that subject. Those usually bring along with them some sort of non-disclosure agreement. Does the legal process in cases like this end up helping the problem to be perpetuated because they usually don't involve a press conference and some sort of open disclosure?
That's a very good question, and if Jeff wants to weigh in on this after I weigh in, I want to get his thoughts too. But yes, and for attorneys, you have to weigh, sometimes clients don't want to have to go through this. Sometimes, clients want to see if they can get some justice for themselves and move on. In cases like this, the reality is when a very powerful institution that has ignored somebody for 30 years pays a bit of money, that is symbolic that they finally have stepped up and said, we had a part in this. With that said, it absolutely, without lawsuits being filed, with non-disclosure agreements, it does perpetuate the problem because the spotlight is not shown like it is being shown today. And it does perpetuate the problem. So it's a difficult thing. And so I just want to point out, and this is clear, we did not have any part of leaking this to Mormon Leaks. Ryan McKnight is here. McKenna, that recording, she leaked it to, she told a lot of people about that. She sent that to a lot of media. We don't know which media did that. And at first, that was a shock to us. We didn't know it was going to come out. But in retrospect, I appreciate Mormon Leaks, because Mormon Leaks is doing what they are supposed to be doing. That was a document that needed to have been leaked so that the story could be told. It forced our hand. The settlement negotiation shut down, and that's fine. And we're handling it in the litigation. But the good part about that is we don't have to worry about a non-disclosure agreement. So that's the good part about that. But good question, Don. Thanks. Ben, you got another question?
To that end, how are you anticipating litigation to go? Because you're looking at hours of depositions. You're looking at probably discovery that you've never seen before. Are you prepared for that?
Oh, I am absolutely prepared for that. I think what made me more prepared for that, Ben, thank you for asking that question, is the dossier the church brought up. Trying to victim shame and smear my reputation and try to cause me to be quiet. One of the most disturbing things about that dossier that Craig mentioned about my daughter that was given up through social services, LDS social services, is the fact that her name was mentioned in that dossier. She was named in that dossier. What a breach of privacy for her. For her. What a terrible thing to do to somebody. If she didn't know she was adopted and she just suddenly read her name in the newspaper or heard it on the news, who does that? Why do you do that? So I'm ready for this. I have been ready. I think what makes me feel even more confident is, besides the support, which has been amazing, and thank you, I'm right. It happened. I was raped at the MTC, the church covered it up, and they still promoted him into higher and higher positions in the church. Today, he is still an active card-bearing member of the church. That means he has a temple recommend, as far as we know. So that the fact that I'm right, and the fact that this might open the door for so many other victims to come forward, I'm ready.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Stephen Clark from the Public. My question is about credibility and transparency of the current leadership of the LDS Church. As a public person, it's difficult for me to trust the current leadership in the context of the history of secrecy, not only on sex abuse, but on financial holdings of the LDS Church. So how can we trust the current leadership to change an inbred cultural problem and who keep their finances secret?
Brilliant question. Craig can answer that.
Yeah, that is a great question. I am going to, punt on this, with the exception of, I agree, there is secrecy in the church, and frankly, this is going to segue to the problem we're talking about. Because of that, they do not want the police to be involved in these situations, other people involved in situations, and that's a real problem. We just can't comment on anything else. I don't have enough knowledge, except that I used to be a member of the church, and I agree that I never knew about their finances. So thank you for your question.
Yes.
But I do recognize it's a private organization and they have the right to do what they want to do. It's not a public entity, so if they have a right to do that. And so I respect that right as well for the church. So.
Craig, during discovery, will you, these calls that come from bishops to that hotline, will you ask for numbers, will you ask for data about how much, how many, what they do in those particular instances?
Well, let me.
I want to let Jeff answer this.
Let me field that one. And again, I'm sorry, I don't want to punt on the legal questions, except we now have filed a lawsuit and we have thoughts of how we're going to go forward. And I'm sure that David Jordan and his folks have thoughts on how they're going to fight it. So I don't really want to respond to that question. I suppose you could, if the church ever makes anyone available for your questions, you could ask them. Are you going to provide that if it's asked?
It would be required, right?
Well, there are ways in litigation when a party doesn't want to disclose something and thinks that legally they don't have an obligation. You know, they will oppose it. There can be another hearing before the court. The court makes a decision on it. So who knows what we're in for? Well, we do know what we're in for. So.
Yes, Ben?
Oh, sorry. In another lawsuit in litigation you have brought against the LDS Church, you sought to depose then-President Thomas S. Monson. Are you seeking to depose LDS Church leadership in this particular litigation?
Well, certainly we understand that Robert E. Wells is still alive, and he's a key figure in this. That is who, according to how we viewed the recording, Joseph Bishop confessed, you know, all of his sins, including his history of sexual addiction, his history of being a sexual predator, to Robert E. Wells when he was a mission president in Argentina before he was called to be the MTC president. So we want to depose him. And just on that, these books are no longer available, but Joseph wrote books. I think he wrote more. One's called The Making of a Missionary by Joseph L. Bishop. This was published in 1982. He left Argentina as mission president, and before he was called as MTC mission president. Love and admiration to his mentor. Another book was written called Peace Be Unto the Soul by Joseph L. Bishop. This one was written well after the fact, I think in, I should have this.
It's after his wife died.
Yeah, looks like 2012, very recent. And if you look on the back, the foreword of that book was written by Robert E. Wells, General Authority Emeritus. I just bring that up. I don't know what that means, but I thought that was interesting.
So you will seek to depose Elder Wells?
We will, certainly. He is a key figure in this case, and we need to depose him to prove our case. Go ahead. We'll go you, sir, and then Brady, and then on that side.
Stephen Clark.
Yes, Stephen.
In Utah, how will you be protected in the judicial system when this case goes before an LDS judge who has been through the endowment ceremony and has taken secret oaths of allegiance upon death to the LDS Church?
How do you handle this one?
We trust the judicial process. You bring up a very good point. We've talked about that. We really hope we can get a fair shake. But thank you for bringing that point up.
Can I add to that?
And yes, Jeff, go ahead.
So we filed in federal court. We have an outstanding federal bench in this state. If the judge who is who pulls this case, so to speak, is someone you've described, and if that judge believes that, I assume it would be a he, because I'm not of the faith, so I don't know. But he feels that he would be unable to preside over this case, then that judge has the ability to recuse himself.
I don't think that's good enough. I don't think a judge should make that decision about his or her recusement in a matter if they are an active temple recommend holding member of the LDS Church.
Well, I appreciate your opinion, but your opinion is not, unfortunately, the way the federal courts work. So.
Go ahead, Brady.
You said you were in settlement talks before the tape came out. Are you still open to a settlement? Or are you committed now to taking this through to getting everything out there?
We're always open to talking to the church about resolving the case. Always open to that. I don't know if that door will ever be open again, but we're open to it. Go ahead.
Scarlett Swallow, survivor coordinator for Protect LDS Children. My question is for other survivors. How should they contact you or contact other lawyers about moving forward with their cases of church cover-up of their abuse or rape?
You know, my information, Jeff's information, is on the complaint and on the press advisory. They certainly can email us. Another great resource, again, is SNAP, that I talked about before. There's attorneys, we have a network of attorneys that we work with throughout the country, and so we could, you know, hopefully help people. I mean, understanding all these cases, it's difficult. There's always a statute of limitations issue, and there is in this case, and I'm not going to go into that, but it's always difficult to bring these cases legally, you know, so far after the fact. But some states are better. It just depends on the law of the state. Who else had a question? Yes.
I'm Millie Palmer, a member of the public again. I know Utah is currently a one-party reporting state. I don't know the legal terminology for that, but that the church had a lobbyist, also I didn't know that they had lobbyists, lobby for it being a two-party reporting state. Is that something that, like, as a member of the public, I can, like, do something to make sure that doesn't happen, or?
Well, so that was, that was a bill that was floated, or at least there was discussion about a bill being floated. It did not get any traction in this past legislative session, but as a member of the public, if you feel strongly about it, talk to your House member or your senator and give them your thoughts. That would be fantastic.
Great, thank you.
Yes, sir.
Probably for you, when the Harvey Weinstein case came out of some of the actions he did in Utah, there were statute of limitations problems, but they said that in Utah, they might have had a unique case where the clock only ticked if the victim was in the state. If they were outside, it stopped. Is that something that applies to this case or not?
You know, I'm going to let Jeff answer that. We do have a fraud cause of action that... go ahead and answer that.
Well, I think what you're talking about is our criminal charges,
yes.
Which we don't. This is a civil case, so it doesn't apply in our situation, whatever that was or whatever you recall. And unfortunately, because I'm not a criminal defense attorney, I don't know enough to actually explain the situation. But this is a civil case. The statutes of limitation are different than in criminal matters. So.
Okay. I'll get back to you, sir. Anybody else? And then we'll go for, I think, just one or two more and we'll be done. Go ahead.
In part, McKenna or your council, have you been contacted by the Strengthening the Church Members Committee?
I'm going to answer this.
Please answer this.
No, we have not been contacted by that committee. We'll just leave it at that. Thank you. Sam.
So this isn't a question. Sam Young with Protect LDS Children. I just want to make the statement that McKenna, we believe you. We support you. We're so happy that you brought this forward, even with all the challenges that you can face with your history being brought forward. Hey, we love you. We are really happy that this is going to help stop what is happening in my church. Thank you.
All right, I think we're kind of wrapping it up. We appreciate everybody coming. Thanks again. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. This is Hillary.
Matthew, Ryan,
Carol,
Keith,
Ashley,
and I like to play bingo online while listening to Infants on Thrones.
You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com.
And if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes.
I did.
Anyone for the closing prayer?
And please consider donating to us for as little as $1 an episode through Patreon. You can find us at patreon.com/infants. Thanks for listening. Thank you so much for your support.
No more lies. No more lies.
Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.
Infants on Thrones.